I want to start today by simply telling you a story. Let's pretend for a moment that we are able to take a little trip back in time. So we all jump in a time machine and we head back to ancient Israel, but we're not really quite sure when. Okay? We all get out together and somebody around this little city recognizes we're tourists because we have a bunch of cameras hanging off our necks and look like we're from out of town. And so he graciously asks, would you like me to give you a tour of the place? And we say, well, sure, that's great. Show us around. And so he shows us around this city whose former name is Jebus, because the Jebusites used to own it. And he shows us the walls and the fortifications. And we notice the huge valley on the east side and the high walls there, and the huge valley on the southern side and high walls there, and valley even on the west side and high walls there. And it's really, really well protected, except for the north area where it's kind of flat, and if any enemy does approach, that's where it would come from. So they have an extra good size wall there. And he takes us all around. He takes us down to the marketplace, and you see all the animals, some goats and some, bless you, some goats and lambs and stuff, and they're just completely slaughtered and hanging out there, just open in the market. And sometimes you walk by, the smell itself is enough to gross you out, but it's the flavor and the culture of a Middle Eastern market. And so we move around this town, and we've gotten to see a lot of it, and then the guide says, we will save the very best for last. And it's now time to take you to the palace, but I got to give a little disclaimer, because as we go to the palace, the king won't be here, because it's springtime. It's the time when kings go out to war. So the king is not here. But I can show you his palace. And so we say, sure, we'll take that. And we go and we look through the palace, and it's beautiful. And it's got, you know, this huge kitchen area that obviously can put a banquet on for lots and lots of people. And then we see the second floor, and he says, now the very best part, we're going to show you the throne room. Of course, it will be empty because the king is not here, but you can still see it. So he takes us in, and sure enough, there's nobody there on the throne, but it's a beautiful place, and it looks very majestic. And he says, now for the very last part of our tour, I'm going to take you up on top of the palace so you can look out over the city. And so we do, and we go out, and you can see this tremendous view over the city that used to be called Jebus, but now it's called Jerusalem, because 7 years ago, David conquered it, and so now it's his capital. And we're looking out, and we can see all the city, and notice that on the southern part of this palace, there is a room designed to catch the afternoon breezes up on top. It's a kind of a hot place, and so that kind of a room is really nice to have in the summertime. And evidently we get too close, because somebody gets up and they come out of there. So the tour guide says, shh, and, you know, pushes us back and tells us to get away, because evidently we've wakened somebody up, and he would never have brought us up here if he'd known someone's there. But someone gets up, and we look at it, and we notice that it's David. We think, oh, man. The tour guide again apologizes and says, I had no idea. He's not really supposed to be here. I'm not sure what he's doing. I don't know why he was taking a nap in the afternoon. He's not that old. He's not sick. I don't know why he was, but we stand back and we watch, and he goes close to the edge, and he looks out over and he sees this part of the city and looks to the south. And he looks over at one spot and he keeps staring. We don't know what he's looking at exactly. But we listen to him, and he summons one of his servants, and he says to his servant, come on over here. I want to ask you some questions. He says, you know, it's amazing how you can live in a city for so long and really not know your neighbors. Who lives in that spot over there? The servant tells him. He says, well, who lives in the house down there? The servant tells him. And who lives in that one right there with the courtyard? Well, that would be Uriah, your majesty, one of your 30 mighty men, one of your mighty generals. That's right, that's right. And his wife, she has been to the palace. Her name is, and the messenger says it's Bathsheba. That's right, that's right. She's been here, and I wonder what it's like to have your husband off to war. It must be very lonely. I wonder if there's something we could do. Tell you what, why don't you go down and get her and summon her to the palace? We don't know exactly what it sounded like or what it looked like, but the Bible tells us that it was adultery, no matter how he might have couched it or how he might have thought of it or what kind of terms he put it in, a fling or affair or some such thing. The Bible says that the penalty, of course, is the same. For kings or commoners, it is, in fact, death. So he sends her back home afterwards, and surely must have thought to himself, well, you know, that's taken care of. No one will ever know. Until 6 weeks later, he gets this very short note, and it's signed, and says, I am pregnant, signed B. And he gets this really ugly feeling in his stomach, and he says, man, I know what the penalty is, and I've got to find some way to cover this up. And so he hatches this plan. decides to bring her husband home from the battlefield. And so he sends for Uriah to come home. And he really works on his introduction because he knows and Uriah knows you just don't bring one of your 30 mighty men home from the battlefield just to do the work of a messenger. So he looks at him and Uriah shows up and is surprised and doesn't know why he's there. And David looks at him and says, I can't tell you how lonely it is back here, you know, doing all this silly administration work. I really wish I were out on the battlefield. So tell me, you know better than anybody else. What's the morale of the troops? And what's the strategy that Joab is using? What's it like? Just fill me in, Uriah. Tell me what's going on. And so Uriah does his best to do that, to tell about all the strategy out on the battlefield to his commander-in-chief. David seems to be satisfied and afterwards says to Uriah, thanks so much for coming. I can't tell you how much this means to me. Why don't you go home now? And so Uriah goes out, but he doesn't go home. He spends the night in the palace. He refuses to go to his house. Again, we don't know exactly how David found out. Maybe it was over breakfast the next morning. David's sitting down at his ham and eggs, or not ham and eggs, it's a good Jewish king, his bagel and eggs. And the waiter comes up to him and gives him his food and says, Your Majesty, it was a great night. Uriah just kept us up all night with stories of what was going on at the front and probably ruined David's breakfast. And he said, what do you mean he kept up all night? Yeah, he was here. He slept with us. He stayed here with the palace servants. And so again, David doesn't know exactly what's going on in Uriah's head. So he calls him and summons him back and says, Uriah, come on back. You know, things have really changed since I was a soldier. Why didn't you go home last night? Uriah looks at him and says, Your Majesty, I couldn't do it. Not when my men are out in the field, not when they are out there sleeping in tents. I just couldn't go home and enjoy the love of my family and the love of my wife and sleep in a very comfortable place. I had to stay here. David looks at him, doesn't know if he's just really noble or he's suspicious. It doesn't really matter, though, because David hatches another plot. And David says, you know, Uriah, I'm working on another message, and I haven't got it ready yet. A message for Joab, and I want you to carry it back for me, but it won't be ready today. So why don't you come over tonight, and we'll have a bone to chew, and something to eat, and something to drink, and then you can spend the night, and then you can take the message the next day. Of course, what David's thinking is he'll get Uriah over and get him drunk, and then send him off home with his wife. Problem is that doesn't really work, because his Uriah's problem is not lack of inhibition. The guy's a noble man. So he comes over and David tries to get him drunk, but it doesn't work. And so he again spends the night in the palace. So the next morning, David does indeed craft a message to Joab. And what it basically is a death warrant. What it says is to Joab, I want you to send the men right up close to the walls of the city that you're attacking and make sure that Uriah leads them. And everyone would know this is really foolish, stupid strategy. But David puts that strategy in the note and seals it up. And Uriah carries this to Joab. And Joab is a general, so he takes a look at it. And he knows this is stupid, but he's a general. So he takes orders from the commander-in-chief. The reason it's so silly is because everyone knows that if you take the army and march them right up next to the walls, that anybody on the other side of the walls can throw something over. In fact, there's a story in the book of Judges about a guy named Abimelech who did that very thing. And a woman threw a millstone out and crushed his head. And so he's kind of, you know, military history 101. Don't be a bonehead. Don't pull an Abimelech. Don't go up close to the walls. And yet Joab listens to his commander-in-chief, and so he sends the troops up, and sure enough they die. Sure enough, Uriah dies. So he writes it in a note and sends it back with a messenger and tells the messenger, make sure you include this part about Uriah. And I'm sure on the way back to Jerusalem, the messenger is saying to himself, Joab is going to be in so much trouble for pulling this kind of a stunt. I mean, this kind of strategy is so foolish. David knows military strategy, and when I tell him what happened, David will be furious. So he shows him the note and fills in the details and says, you know, one of your 30 mighty men, Uriah, has died too. The messenger can't believe how stoically David takes it. David just looks at it and says, well, you know, that's the way it is in battle. You know, the sword devours one, the sword devours another. You win some, you lose some. That's just the way it goes. The messenger goes back to the camp just totally puzzled, can't believe how David can take this. Of course, a couple weeks later, David takes Bathsheba into his house and marries her. 7 months later, the baby is born. Everybody, of course, in the palace can count to nine, but no one knows for sure if the baby is premature or not. And David says to himself, that's it, it's covered, it's done, no one will ever know. But of course, somebody does know. Number one, God knows. Number two, Nathan knows. We don't know if Nathan is just a shrewd observer of what goes on in the court, or if in fact God himself reveals directly to Nathan what's happened. But Nathan knows what's going on here, and Nathan's a prophet, and he won't let it go. So he goes to David, and again, he works on his introduction because he knows that David's already killed somebody once to cover up his sin. So he goes and he thinks of an analogy where David might be a little bit more tender. David's not very tender when it comes to stealing people's wives or their lives, but he says, I'll cast it in terms of sheep. He says, Your Majesty, I have a story to tell you. The story goes like this. There was a guy who had one little sheep, and it was his favorite animal. It was the only one that he had, and he took care of it like it was his own child. And there was a guy next door across the road that had a whole herd of sheep, and when one of his friends came to town, he went across the road and took that one little sheep and slaughtered it to give as a barbecue to his friend. And when David heard the story, his fist comes down on the throne. He says, the guy who did this ought to pay back fourfold what he took. That is so wrong. That is unjust. That man needs to be condemned. And when he says those words, he really pronounces his own fate, because Nathan looks at him and says, David, you are the man. You are the one. You are the one who took your neighbor's life, and you're the one who took your neighbor's wife, and God saw all that you have done, and you pronounced the judgment and said, the man who took that has to give back fourfold, and that's exactly what you're going to do. You took one life of Uriah, and you're going to have to give back four lives of your sons. And sure enough, his son Adonijah, who was just 3 years old when this happened, grows up to be killed. His son Absalom rebels against him and dies. His son Amnon rapes his half-sister Tamar and is killed by Absalom. And another one of his sons dies as well. And David has to pay back fourfold. Now, as you take a look at that story, and as you listen to the story, and you've been very gracious to listen to me tell it, you realize that what I've told you here isn't anything you haven't heard before. Yeah, maybe some of the details, but those are mostly imaginative details that we've made up just to try to bring this story a little bit more to life. But the truth is that in the story, it didn't really teach you anything new. Right? If you wanted to really boil it down and say, what did we learn from the story? You'd say, well, number one, you don't commit adultery. Number two, you don't commit murder. Right? That's pretty much what the story teaches, or that's the teaching that's there. What the story does is take those truths and put flesh on them, put feeling on them, help you understand it. The first time I heard a guy tell a story like this, I felt like I was sitting in a theater, you know, where you see somebody on the screen doing something scary and you want to yell out, no, don't open the door, you know. I felt like when David's looking down at the courtyard, I just want to say, David, stop. Don't do that. Because the stories are supposed to just reach out and touch more than just your head. It's also supposed to touch your heart and help you to feel it. Right? And as you look at 1 and 2 Samuel, is it simply stories of kings and princes? No, they're stories with a point. But the point is, that the truth is that they're an awful lot of just story after story after story here, aren't there? They really are. So I want to talk to you just a little bit about the narrative here. And this is going to sound pretty familiar because we talked about narrative genre, but I think this is the perfect place just to reinforce the big idea about why would we use these kind of stories. And the first one is this. The first big idea is this. Narrative draws the reader into the story, allowing us to see and to feel the truth. Now, those are not usually adjectives that we use or verbs we use when it comes to the truth, but that's what stories are about, helping to visualize and helping you to, you know, feel it down in the pit of your stomach, to feel the truth here. Number two, second big idea is that it illustrates, and that's the key word here in bold, right? It illustrates propositional truths that are taught elsewhere. Do not murder and do not commit adultery are, you know, obvious themes that are taught elsewhere. This book doesn't actually teach them as much as it illustrates the problem with those things. So it illustrates the propositional truth is found elsewhere. Well, my point here is that as you're looking through these stories, you're not looking for lots of new truths. You're looking for powerful illustrations to help you see and feel the truth that we often find elsewhere. Now, in the past, when we talked about the genre of narrative, we used some pictures. Remember these? Remember the cartoons? Can you tell me what we were trying to bring out with these two cartoons? This one's pretty simple, right? I mean, the whole story is told here. And the idea was that Old Testament stories are not like that. In fact, even New Testament, they're really more like this. You have to have the caption there to help you understand what's going on. If you don't have the caption, you can't really get it. So the point was to look for captions. Because are we left to our own to find out what they illustrate? Does each story have a moral of its own? Is it simply a good collection of stories? And the answer is no, not at all. Or if we were to be really good Hebrews, we would say, lo. Yeah, exactly, right. Okay, you get extra credit for knowing that. Lo, not. No, not at all. All biblical narratives are well-written and very selected literary pieces which point to a singular theme. We're only including the stories that we want to tell the point. That's why you have to pay attention to everything that's there. That's why you don't try to understand what isn't there. Just leave it out. These are well-written and very selected. They only choose the parts of the stories which are going to point to this theme. And that theme or that propositional truth is always stated within the book and usually early in the book. Now, it only makes sense that you're going to state the theme in the book and early in the book. Why do you state the theme early in the book? I think it should be self-evident, but I just want to make sure. Why do you state it early in the book? Yeah, you read the book with a theme in mind, you understand the pictures when you see them, right? You have the caption in the beginning, and all the stories seem to make some sense. So, these are well-written, very selected literary pieces which point to a singular theme, and that propositional truth or theme is always stated in the book and usually early in the book. So when we ask ourselves, what is the proposition or the point of Samuel, we have to ask, where do we find statements of truth early in the book? So, what I'd like you to do is to open up your Bibles with me to 1 and 2 Samuel, and let's take a look at it. Because as much as David seems to be the hero of these books, or Saul the anti-hero of these books, when the book starts out, it doesn't really start with David, does it? Or even with Saul. Who does the book start with? In fact, it doesn't. Yeah, well, Samuel, kind of, but really didn't even start with Samuel. Yeah, it starts with Samuel's mom, whose name is Hannah, right? Starts with Hannah, and it really is her story. So the author doesn't have to do that, right? He's not simply trying to say everything that happened. He says Hannah is the perfect person to start with, because she evidently is going to illustrate this theme. Now, Hannah happens to be married to the same guy that some other woman is married to. I don't know exactly what you call this relationship. Hannah has a co-wife, I guess, or a rival, as the text says. What's that wife's name? Do you know? Did you read carefully enough to notice? Her name is Peninnah, chapter 1 and verse 2. Elkanah is the guy. Elkanah, verse 2, had two wives. One was called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. So this is a terrible disgrace for her. She wants to have children. Elkanah loves her and gives her a double portion of things. And he's good to her. He cares for her, but she doesn't have any children. So they go up to the festival at Shiloh at least three times a year. And it's a time of celebration, and even in the midst of the celebration, it makes it even more difficult because she doesn't have children, and she's feeling really left out. Verse 6 says, "And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival, Peninnah, kept provoking her in order to irritate her." So it's not like she doesn't have any children. Her rival is pretty mean about it. Okay, so she goes to God and prays at the temple, or at the tabernacle. It's not temple yet. Prays the tabernacle, and Eli thinks that she is drunk, right? She says, "No, I'm not really drunk. I'm just praying and mouthing the words, but not saying anything." And he comes up to her and says, "Well, may God grant your wish." So the wish, of course, is for a boy named Samuel, and Samuel is then born. And it takes several years up to this point, but eventually Samuel is born, and he is weaned, and she takes him back to the temple. Now, when she takes him back to the temple, that's kind of the end of chapter 1. And then what you have in chapter 2 is this wonderful poem that kind of summarizes and explains chapter 1. Now, look with me at the poem in chapter 2. Right? "Then Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart rejoices in the Lord, in the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly, or let your mouth speak such arrogance. For the Lord is a God who knows, and by Him deeds are weighed. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry hunger no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, but she who has had many sons pines away. So do you see the theme here? I mean, it's the very same thing. She's just saying it different ways. You catch what it is? Look at the next verse. The Lord brings death and makes alive, verse 6. He brings down to the grave and He raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and He exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. Some of the ways I have described it are simply like this. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and He exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. It's not by strength that one prevails. Kind of trying to use the colors here, okay? Like the purple being the good stuff and the yellow being the negative stuff. And the point, as you move through these books, is that it doesn't really matter what kind of power you have. It doesn't matter kind of what prestige or advantages you have. It's whether or not God is on your side. And God is on your side because He's on the side of those who are humble, not those who are proud. So the big idea here simply is it doesn't matter what advantages you have. It matters whether God is on your side. And God is on the side of the humble. God gives grace to the humble. James just didn't make that up, you know, in James chapter 4. He reads it here in the Old Testament. And so God will lift up the humble and He will put down the proud. Now, as you look at this book and you look at the stories in this book, do as you read through these stories, do you find some proud people who are brought low? Well, let's hope so, or I'm totally wrong about this, right? Who are some of the proud people? Who are some of the big people who have these big natural advantages who are brought low? Yeah, Saul is, for one, right? He's head and shoulders above everybody else. Can think of some other big people who are brought low in these books? Yeah, Goliath, for one, right? And he is brought low by whom? By a little guy that everybody despises, whom God lifts up, right? So the proud are brought low, and the humble are lifted up. And the story of this book is one of those things. Now, the other side of the coin, or the continuation of the story, is just because God does this kind of action once doesn't mean it's always going to stay there. Because what happens if this humble person gets lifted up and up here he gets proud? Then he gets brought low too, right? And you see that with a number of characters. Who do you see that with? Saul starts out as a humble guy, right? And then he is lifted up and he's exalted for a while, and then Saul gets proud and he's put back down. Who else do you see it with? Yeah, ultimately David. And I think this is the ultimate story of the book here. Because David is this humble servant shepherd boy, you know, the 7th or 8th in his family, who is lifted up and God uses him. But even though David is the man in this book, what happens to David? When his heart gets proud, what does God do? God brings him low. And as we as you take a look through this through the book, I've stated here this truth gives unity to the whole book. You will notice the A points, if you flip over to page like 93 and 94. These A points are written fairly complex terms of fidelity and infidelity. But you could almost rewrite the whole book like this. Like God prospers faithful Hannah. 2a, God hinders unfaithful Israel. 3, God prospers faithful Saul. 4a, God hinders unfaithful Saul. All right? 5a is a little bit of both. At the end of 5a, God prospers David alone because Saul is dead. But here's the point. 6a, God hinders unfaithful David. So you got God raising up the humble and putting down the proud. And sometimes it's the same person at various stages of their life. Now, go back with me to page 91 and take a look at David's life. See the bottom of page 91? I think it's... Is that what yours looks like? Yes, bottom of page 91. This is 2 Samuel chapters 2 and 3. David's strength increases and God is blessing him and honoring him. In 2 Samuel... chapters 3 to 5, he unites the nation behind him. Everybody begins to follow him, and he is the united king, which is a wise thing on his side, but also little evidence of God's blessing. And then in chapter 6, he determines a central place of worship. Is it a good idea or a bad idea? And the answer is, obviously, it's a really good idea. Because worship is pretty central to the life of the nation, isn't it? Remember, we looked at Deuteronomy, we took a look at those bookends, right, and said the most important part of national legislation is the national worship. And so David gets to be king, and one of the first things he does is centralize the worship in one spot. It's a really good thing. It's a way to honor God, and God honors him. He establishes his throne in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And what's happening here is we're just moving up and up and up and up until you get to 2 Samuel chapters 10 and 12, and this is the story we just looked at, you know, with Uriah and Bathsheba. And then in the rest of the book, what happens? Well, chapter 13, his son Amnon rapes his sister, half-sister Tamar, and dies. And then Absalom rebels in 14 and 19, and then there's more rebellion in chapter 20. So if you look at David's life here, the first part of it is like this, and the second part of it is like this. And I suppose if you want to find a microcosm of the book, or maybe the very best example of the book, it's even David's own life. God makes these really unconditional promises to him that are just some of the most amazing installments of the messianic promise we have seen since Abraham. But it doesn't matter. Even if you are one of God's favorite guys, God's not going to ignore. And if you get proud and turn away from him, there will be consequences that come into one's life. Right? So it does not matter necessarily what advantages you have. It does not matter how faithful you've been in the past. It matters whether or not we're continuing to live in a humble kind of a way in front of our God. And David's life is one of the best examples. So there is the first big idea, the first half of what I want to share with you today. All right? You good so far? This is really good coffee. Thanks for getting it for me. Who got it for me? I trusted you because you could have put anything in here, couldn't you? You could have put anything in here. Of course, I don't know what you put. It makes me kind of nervous now. Think about it. No, I'm not nervous. Okay, that's good. All right, halftime. Here we go. Here's halftime. Well, I guess I'll have the ham and eggs. Okay, let's go on. The Davidic covenants, God's most significant promise to David, 2 Samuel chapter 7. When we talked about David's throne being established in that little pyramid chart we just looked at, this is what we're talking about. We've mentioned this before when we got to Amos chapter 9 because it was the necessary background to Amos chapter 9. I want to go into it in detail right now. And you're familiar with a little bit of it because of Amos 9. This is the part where David wants to build a permanent temple house for God. God says, basically, thanks but no thanks. If you turn over to page 94, you got the whole text here, okay? You can see the whole text at the bottom of page 94. So David says, I want to build a house for you, and God says, thanks but no thanks, I want to build a house for you. And the Lord tells you he will make you a house. And this is the reference to the fact that David will have a dynasty. He'll have sons after sons after sons who reign on the throne after him. And in fact, in this passage, God says, don't worry about building me a temple because one of these sons will, in fact, build me a temple. The text says, I will set up your seed after you who will come from your own body. So this promise concerns one of David's real-life physical descendants. And he shall build a house for me. And what he's talking about is the son will build a temple. And then the text goes on to say, and I will establish his throne forever, so the son will never lose the throne. So 2 Samuel chapter 7 is the reference that tells us that unlike Saul, David will have sons who will reign on the throne. And be assured, David, that one of those sons will build a permanent temple for me, and I will put him on his throne, and he will reign forever. Now, as you take a look at the fulfillment of this promise, in some ways it's very, very easy and very, very clear because all of us know that the person who fulfills the promise is Solomon, right? Who is the son? It's got to be Solomon because he's a physical descendant. He builds a temple and he reigns on the throne. But one small problem. What's the small problem here? He dies. Yeah, like all those other losers, right? He dies. So he does not reign on the throne forever, exactly. So if we're going to give him a perfect rating of 3, what's Solomon get? It's like a 2.5, don't you think? Okay, it's like a 2.5. I'll give him that. So, if Solomon's not the one who does it, then we all know that the person who fulfills this is, let's all say it together, Zerubbabel. Right? Yeah, Zerubbabel really is the next one. That's the reason why we talk about him, why we talk about God raising up 2 people, you know, the royal, the priestly, and then the royal, because Zerubbabel really is a very important messianic kind of figure. When he comes back here, nobody expects Joshua to rebuild the temple. Everybody expects the son of David, Zerubbabel, to rebuild the temple. And that's exactly what he does. He's a physical descendant of David, and he builds the temple. But you all know where he fails, right? He fails in his prophecy because he does not, well, he dies, yeah, but he does not reign at all. And that's the whole point. The problem is he doesn't reign at all. Doesn't reign on a throne, let alone forever. So if we're going to, again, give these guys ratings of 3.0 for perfection, what's he get? Gets a 2. So then we come to Jesus, everybody wants to. Number one, he's a physical descendant, but the next two are kind of shady here. Or are they? Does he build a temple? Well, you can come along, you can kind of spiritualize it and say, well, he builds a church. That's about the same thing as a temple, isn't it? And the answer is, no, not really. It's not the same thing as a temple. But Jesus said some things about building temples. Do you remember that? The disciples were looking at the temple, and they said, look how beautiful this is. And Jesus said, hey, if you tear this thing down, I'll build it back in 3 days. And they looked at him like he was nuts, and they said, are you kidding? We've been working on this thing for 46 years. Because during Herod's time, they had been rebuilding Zerubbabel's temple. We've been working on this thing, at least on the rebuilding of it, for 46 years, and we're not done yet. How in the world can you do this? And John says, when he spoke of this, he was speaking of what? Speaking of his body, talking about being in the grave 3 days and coming back alive. But I don't think that exhausts the reference. My guess is, according to the book of Ezekiel, there will be a temple in the millennium. Probably be used for memorials or some such thing, but there will be a temple in the millennium, according to Ezekiel. And my guess is that when that millennium dawns, that Messiah, in fact, will build it. Now, that's just, it's not just my thinking. I think it's true based on Ezekiel. But then it says, reign on the throne forever. And at that point in time, he will sit on his father David's throne and not only rule over Jerusalem, but rule over the entire world. So as you look at Jesus, again, of those 3 things, only one of them has he done so far. But I think he will do the other 2. And then eventually, finally, ultimately, fully, this promise given to David in 2 Samuel 7 will be fulfilled. It's again one of the reasons why I think there's a future for the nation of Israel, why there's going to be a temple, and why he will reign on the throne in Jerusalem like his father did forever. So let's put this in the context of where we've been in this class so far. Okay, haven't seen this chart for a long time, but it's time to start building up on it again. If we looked at those 3 passages that are up there, we know that those describe the ancestor of Messiah. Genesis chapter 3 says that Messiah will come from the person's name I'm looking for here, Eve. Genesis 12, he will also be a son of Abraham. And Genesis 49, he'll be a son of Judah, right? And now we can place this one square on top of that and say he will also be a descendant of David. Now, before the semester is over, we will add several more layers to the top of that little messianic chart. But they'll be different than these first 4. Because the thing these first 4 have in common that the other layers don't is these first 4 deal with who. Every one of these has to do with he'll be a descendant of whom. Right? Eve, Abraham, Judah, and David. And this is the last one we ever get. 2 Samuel 7 is the last promise we ever get that deals with who. And that's why in the New Testament, this name is applied to Jesus more than any other. He is the son of David. Why? Because it's the last descendant who we're told about that he's going to come from. So when blind Bartimaeus is crying out for a temple, crying out, my words mixed up today. When he cries out for a miracle, he says, son of David, have mercy on me. This is what he's referring to, okay? The son of David. We could also do it like this in a chart and put David down there at the bottom, tracing the seed from beginning to end. And we could even add it to this one. In fact, we could add several other names to this who are good pictures of the seed. Besides Noah, Isaac, and Joseph, we can put in there Solomon, and now who else? Come on, don't forget him. Just leave him in his rumble there. He deserves a spot, right? And David. I suppose if you were to ask me who I thought were the very best pictures of the seed in the Old Testament, it would be a tie between Joseph and David. Joseph, such the pure leader there who rescues the nation in Genesis. But David, so much about David. He's a shepherd. He's born in Bethlehem. He unites all the 12 tribes. He is the king. He is on the throne. He is rejected by his people the first time, but he is accepted the second time. And just so many things about David that really, really work as a good picture.